Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to The Collision, where sports and politics collide here at your home for jazz and justice on WPFW in Washington, D.C., and also on WBAI in New York City. So I'm your co-host, Chuck Modiano, and I'm going to start with the bad news, and then I'm going to get to the good news. Co-hosts Dave Zirin and Etan Thomas will not be with us today, but we have an incredible co-host on the back end of this show. And that is you. We're going to take some callers. We haven't done that in some time, but we're going to take some callers in the back half. So if you want to weigh in, and we're going to talk a little bit about a media shift, and then we're going to talk about a media shift. We're going to talk about a media shift and cracks in whether there is a genocide or not. Not from WPFW, we've been talking about this for a very long time, not from independent spaces, but cracks in mainstream circles about, is this a genocide, from the places and the people that have been covering it up, from the New York Times to Washington Post to The Economist, to Financial Times, to Matthew Miller, who was lying in press conferences with Biden. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but then we're going to get to some sports. We're going to get to my Knicks. We're going to talk about my Knicks and put this season in perspective. We're going to talk about Tom Thibodeau's firing. I have strong opinions on this. I'm really happy to share them with you and talk a little bit of hoops along the way. Time permitting, we could get a little bit into the WNBA as well. Talk maybe a little about Fever without Caitlin and what that looks like. But really, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you at the bottom of the hour. There has been times in the past, a collision, we have had time to do that. And by going solo, I want to hear from you. So if you don't agree with anything I said, you know, feel free to challenge. You know, I'm wrong once in a while. Once in a while, I'm wrong. You know, not that much, but once in a while. So we could talk about that. So we really look forward to getting some calls on the bottom half of the hour. But let me start with something that I think is pivotal. I think it's pivotal when we're talking about Israel, is that since October 2023, there has been a flat out cover-up of a genocide at the highest level, at the highest possible levels. 153 countries have said, yes, this is a genocide. I said, yes, we want a permanent ceasefire. And every time that vote would go to the UN Security Council, it would end up 14-1. And we couldn't stop the ceasefire because one country with veto power out of five countries, that's the United States, would block the ceasefire. That's just happened for the fourth time, by the way. And it's 14-1. The 14-1 is the UN Security Council. So America alone has been the impediment to stopping the genocide, let alone, you know, sending billions to arm Israel. But before it's before you even get to that, America, just by abstaining, we have a different situation. So you have this cover-up. And no matter how many human rights organizations, no matter how many countries that are the United States try to speak the truth and speak their mind, there's no headway being made. Whether it was the South Africa ICC report, ICJ report, whether it was the ICC report, whether it was even Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem talking about Welcome to Hell, the torture report in August of 2024, really talking about what is happening with the Palestinian hostages who are being tortured and just rounded up in tens of thousands. They don't talk about those hostages, right? And you have the Human Rights Watch report. You have countless reports, and I'm going to stop at Amnesty International's report, 300-page report, which came out in December of 2024. And I think what's interesting about the Amnesty International report is they have 80 pages dedicated to genocidal quotes, intent of genocide, that come straight out of the mouths of Israeli leaders. Probably the most famous one is Yoav Gallant talking about, hey, we're going to treat Palestinians like human animals. We're going to treat them accordingly. They are human animals. We're going to treat them accordingly. No food, no water, confessing right away in October 2023 to what the Geneva Convention says are undoubtedly war crimes. These are war crimes. And what's so interesting here is that you have confessions from Israeli leaders. It's the easiest war crime to ever document, because they're saying what they're doing. Like, you would never see a police officer say, yeah, I did it. Yeah, I killed him. They say, oh, I feared for my life. Like, they run for cover. Almost every police officer. But they're so emboldened in Israel with America's backup that they could just say, yeah, we're committing war crimes. And then it will just continue. So what has happened in the last month or so is something different. It's not WPFW. It's not Breakthrough News. It's not people on social media. We're seeing people like the Washington Post have an article that, oh, I'm starting to see the light now. Now it's genocide. We're seeing the New York Times have similar articles. I mean, even Haaretz, Israeli's Haaretz newspaper back in January 2025, said, yes, it's genocide. You're hearing more admissions from the Israeli press than you are from the American press. And the Zionism that is part of the Israeli press is a little different, because a lot of the press are saying, yeah, it's a genocide, but you know what? We're going to do it anyway. And they try to justify the genocide. Whereas in America, it's deny the genocide, right? It's not happening. And we're finally seeing those cracks. Piers Morgan, you know, Mr. Do you condemn Hamas? Like, you would start every single interview with, do you condemn Hamas? The Zionists are coming after him now. They're coming after Piers Morgan. This is what if Piers Morgan can make a shift, doesn't mean, like, you know, I'm going to forgive Piers Morgan for everything he's ever said. But Piers Morgan is making a shift. The Economist, the Financial Times, these are not, like, not only are they not, like, leftist publications, they are liberal publications. And then the question becomes, what's going on? You just see the light now. These are reporters. They know what's going on. They have inside information that I don't even have. So I think what we're seeing is people covering their butts. People are seeing that the protests have been working. And when people say the protests don't work, nothing is happening, but we are seeing in real time the needle move, that you're cracking the mainstream places. You're cracking the mainstream media, the corporate media, because they don't want to be complicit in genocide. So they're trying to, the dominoes are falling of going on record. Oh, after further study and review, after I dismissed 10 human rights organization reports over 1,000 pages, well, now maybe it could be a genocide. So what we're seeing is people scared that they will be the last one. Like when you see that picture, that famous picture with the young woman in Arkansas, Little Rock, leaving the school, and the white crowd mob is yelling at her. Well, nobody wants to be that white crowd 30, 40 years later. There was like an Oprah episode 40 years later, and they were saying how sorry they were. Nobody wants to be that crowd. And they're seeing you can't stop this. No matter how much you try to ban TikTok, and there's talks now of banning everything, all types of social media, this won't work anymore. You can't hide the truth anymore. You may have billions, but you don't have the truth. And then that leads us to Matthew Miller, okay? Matthew Miller, who is speaking for Biden and lying for over a year, getting question after question, and in a wide-ranging conversation with Sky News, Matthew Miller says, it was without a doubt true that Israeli has committed war crimes. Without a doubt, that his words, that Israeli soldiers were not being held accountable, that there were disagreements along the way on how to handle policy. And he would have wanted a better candidate than Biden as well. This is the State Department spokesperson in 2023. And you could go on social media and just see all these clips of him lying all in the last year. And basically what he said, quote, look, one of the things about being a spokesperson is you're not a spokesperson for yourself. You are a spokesperson for the president, the administration, and you espouse the positions of the administration. And when you're not in the administration, you can just give your own opinion. That's what Matthew Miller said. And I really want people to pay attention, because if you know anything about the Holocaust, and if you know anything about the Nuremberg trials, this is the same defense. I was following orders. I was following orders. That's what Matthew Miller has said. And he said, when you're not in the administration, you can just give your opinion. What is stopping you from giving your opinion while you're in the administration? Tell me what is stopping you. Josh Paul worked in the State Department, and he quit his job and started speaking out and talking about the many war crimes. There were a number of people who left the State Department to speak. What was stopping Matthew Miller from quitting his job and saying then, when it mattered, when Biden had the ability to not veto a UN resolution, why wasn't he saying anything then? So this is cowardly. And then he has other butt-covering language. But what you're seeing is people who are scared because they know they were complicit in genocide, and perhaps legally complicit in genocide. And they are using the same defense that was used by Nazis at the Nuremberg trials. Just following orders. I mean, just following orders. You're not a spokesperson for yourself. Was there any gun to your head? Matthew Miller? We're seeing cracks. And then you could add on, we find out Biden's press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, is coming out with a book, a tell-all book, and now she is an independent. And she's moving, separating herself. And okay, well, I wish you had something to say during the administration. So the point here is, this is a tipping point. You know, we could go on Matthew Miller forever, but we're hitting a tipping point. I hope people see it. We're hitting a moment that activists all know and wait for and fight for and are in the street 24/7. Because we got to crack the mainstream. And all these people knew absolutely that there was a genocide going. None of these people did not know that. So I think this is the way to look at this is not be like, oh, Matthew Miller's a liar. We knew who Matthew Miller was. The way to look at this is for all the people, the millions of people who have been protesting, and you feel disheartened, and you feel like, what am I doing? This? I'm at the 100th protest. I don't see the needle moving. You move the needle. You move, and he's been out there, we've been moving the needle. This is a win for the protesters. This is the win for the people who wouldn't shut up. This is the win for the people who were told to stay quiet because there's an election. When we're trying to stop a genocide, and not a genocide in the next 4 years, a genocide, a forever genocide. Because if you say a genocide, it's fine for the next 4 years, it's the next 40 years at least or more. And that's what I really want to end with at this segment. Is for everybody fighting out there, keep fighting, we're gonna keep fighting. The needle is moving. Unfortunately, the sad part of the whole thing are that there's so many bodies who are dead involved. And let me just put one stat on that. There was a report that came out that was showing the age of young people. And when they counted 1 month old babies, 1 month old, there were more 1 month old babies murdered than Americans killed in 9/11. I'm gonna pause on that one. I'm gonna say that one again. There are more 1 month old babies murdered than there were Americans killed in 9/11. Can you imagine America's reaction if there's like a hospital full of over 3,000 babies intentionally? According to every human rights report that we are looking at, according to our eyes when we watch video. So people are seeing this. They're seeing it on their video. And the lies won't work anymore. So their cracks, that's for the protesters. So I'm going to pause. I could shift the sports. I don't know if you wanted to say the number for the bottom of the hour. Either way, I'm going to shift. It's a tough shift. It's always a tough shift, but we have to talk about what's going on before we get to our sports. When there's genocide, of course. And I'm a Knicks fan. And, you know, I was very happy. After 25 years, we made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. You might have heard. There's this guy. His name is Patrick Ewing. And that was the last time we made the Eastern Conference Finals. If anyone knows New York City or New York fans or New York media, there's some weird thing where we like to blame the best player. So the last few years of Patrick Ewing were really rough because, you know, he's really helping the team, but you'd never know it. They say he's slowing up the offense. And when he was traded, the thanks he got was the New York Post back page said, good riddance. That's what it said, good riddance. Patrick Ewing, the greatest Knick of all time, is said, good riddance. Wow. And, you know, there was a two-year period where, like, there was a honeymoon. The Knicks were good again, and Knicks fans were humble and just happy to be there. And that's all over. That is all over. We made it. It's the old Knicks again. What have you done for me lately? Oh, you made the Eastern Conference Finals. And what is the thanks Tom Thibodeau gets? He gets fired. I'm reading the papers. I mean, I'm reading the news, and I'm like, what? But before we get to, like, he was fired by, you know, Knicks GM and Leon Rose, we have to talk about the fact that if you followed social media, Knicks fans were ripping Tom Thibodeau the whole time. You would think, like, they didn't make the Eastern Conference final. So, like, if Leon Rose made a decision to get rid of Thibodeau, It wasn't terribly unpopular because Knicks fans are generally haters. It is what it is. You know, probably Philly fans are the only worst ones, and, you know, we could fight about that. But Knicks fans are haters, and I have to say this for Leon Rose before I say he's done a tremendous job. He's been the best Knicks GM in a very long time. He put these pieces together. He made these trades. He did it overnight after inheriting a really horrible team. So I have nothing but praise of all the moves that Leon Rose made to get here. So, but in a sense, it's not so much this critique on Rose, but it's a critique on this place that we're in the NBA, where you can just get fired for anything. You know, it used to be egalitarian too, right? I mean, it is egalitarian now. It used to not be. It used to be like black coaches had shorter leashes than white coaches. It's gotten so bad that the way they've made up that gap is now, okay, let's treat white coaches like black coaches and get rid of them as quick. You know, because Monty Williams, a few years ago, he did very well with the Suns, and the Suns moved up and they fired him. And you're like, what? Why did you fire him? And then they've had two new coaches since, and they've just fired those two coaches the next 2 years, and now the Suns aren't even a 500 team. You don't hear about when you fire a coach and the team goes down. You don't hear those stories. I'm going to tell you what you hear. You hear cherry picking, historical cherry picking. Oh, well, Doug Collins was fired and then Phil Jackson came. Some might know, oh, David Blatt was fired and Ron Lue came. And my answer to that is, do we have LeBron or Michael Jordan on the Knicks? I don't think we have LeBron and Michael Jordan. I love Cat, Carl Anthony Towns, and I love Jalen Brunson, but I don't see Michael Jordan or LeBron on the team. And when you have someone at that elite level, in greatest ever level, yeah, you know what? The coaching situation is more fluid. A lot of coaches could win with those players. But the Knicks are not that. Tom Thibodeau brought that team up. Tom Thibodeau had them playing defense again. Tom Thibodeau molded that team cohesively. And the fans he got was bye. And I don't think the previous examples that I've heard, the other third example I hear is some people say Rick Carlisle, who did a tremendous job coaching the Pacers. But when Rick Carlisle in 2003 was the coach for the Pistons, they changed to Larry Brown, and then they won a championship. That's how the story goes. What they don't tell you is that they also got in Rasheed Wallace. And I believe if they did not get Rasheed Wallace, I don't believe the Pistons won a championship. So unless the new coach wants to bring a new version of Rasheed Wallace to the roster, then I would do that. But ask yourself this question. Why are people going back 20 years and 30 years to justify and cherry pick that if you change your coach, success is around the corner? Have you thought about that? That you have to go back 20 and 30 years to find examples? As a general rule, if you have to do that, it's a bad example. So let me give you a more recent example, because there's a Knicks contingent who are saying, hey, we want Mike Malone. For those who don't know, Mike Malone was unceremoniously fired, 8 games left, another unjust fire. Like, I've never had defending more white guys. In the past, I was almost exclusively defending black coaches, but now they're treating the white coaches like black coaches. I'm sure I'm going to defend them too if it's unjust. But here's what's interesting about Mike Malone. You have all these Knicks fans say, hey, we want Mike Malone. He's a championship coach. Well, how did he become a championship coach? Well, I'll tell you. In his fourth year, just like Tom Thibodeau, he reached Game 7 of the second round. In his fifth year, the year that Tom Thibodeau was fired, you know what happened? He made it to the Western Conference Finals. So he makes it to the Western Conference Finals, but Tibbs now is fired. And you know what happened? His sixth year, I know you think I'm going to say they won the championship. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to make a point. In Mike Malone's sixth year, they regressed. They were swept in the second round. In Mike Malone's seventh year, they regressed more. They were bounced in the first round 4-1. They only had one game. That's the seventh year. And each year, they said, no, continuity matters. Let's keep him. And in the eighth year, after regressing 2 years, then they won the championship. Then Denver won the championship and have the best player on the planet with the Joker. But they don't tell you about when continuity works. We remember when there's a change, even if it was like 25 years ago. So I need some statistical evidence to know you're not just being a typical emotional Knicks fan when you bring up 25-year-old examples. Because I have a theory, being a New York fan, you could apply it to the Jets, you could apply it to Knicks, that part of the reason we go decades without winning a championship is that we have an impatient city, and we have an impatient fan base, and we have an impatient media that feeds off that fan base for clicks. So instead of telling those fans they're stupid, which no one in media wants to do, it's like it's suicide. They exploit it. They exploit your emotional need to say, yeah, fire the coach. That's what they do. They exploit the fans, and the fans eat it up. So you hear people who are successful, then we're just told they're not success. Now the wins don't matter. Now what you did doesn't matter. And it's very important in this situation because, you know, the Knicks are like a glove. If you really look at Tom Thibodeau's players, they all play above their capacity where they played elsewhere. No one's talking about Josh Hart as a like important piece before he came to the Knicks. Now you see like jumping for rebounds. They didn't have a great series in this last one, and sometimes series are about matchups. But every single person, generally, when they come to Tom Thibodeau, they play above their means. And I'm going to tell you the greatest mistake for the haters who are listening, who always like to fire the coach people and feel free to push back on me. The greatest mistake that fans make is that they correctly identify a weakness, because I have critiques of Tom Thibodeau. You're not using his subs enough, burning out his starters. That's the main critique. I'm not saying that critique is invalid. It's a valid critique. And I believe if you kept him, he would have made adjustments next year from some of the things that we learned from this series against Indiana. But here's what fans always mess up. They believe the new guy that will correct the flaws of the old guy will bring all their strengths with them too. Yep. They think the new guy automatically has all the strengths of the previous coach, and then we'll just fix their flaws. That's why when you hear anyone who made a decision like that, they should be fired. No, how do you think they got to the Eastern Conference Finals? They just beat the Boston Celtics, the world champions. They weren't supposed to beat them. The Knicks overachieved by beating the Celtics and getting Eastern Conference Finals. But you don't see that. You see two or three plays in a couple of games. That's emotional. And fans are emotional. I get it. I'm a fan sort of fanatic, for those who don't know. It's by definition, it's emotional. But general managers aren't supposed to be. They're not supposed to be emotional. But general managers often are. And I'm not saying it's emotional, but I'm saying what happens is general managers often also play to fan bases too. We're also in a customer service lead. So you see coaches getting fired all the time. So I'm willing to wait to see how this turns out. Obviously, I'm going to root that I'm wrong. I'm going to root for the incoming coach to do well. But I don't see it. And from my vantage point, if anyone's interested, I believe the only person who might fit, and I normally do not like college coaches at all to come to the pros. There's not a good history of that. But this is an outlier situation. Jay Wright, who was the Villanova coach, who won two championships with the Villanova Knicks. And you have three players on those Knicks. He could come in and like have an instant relationship, both in personally and then structurally. So I feel like because of the uniqueness of the situation, it would be a time that I would think he is the right person. I don't think they need to be learning all these new systems or anything else. And I know a lot of people agree with me and disagree with me, and that's fine. But if you disagree, what is your evidence? Don't give me 25-year examples. Don't go back to 2004. I need you to have some evidence, not just emotion. Because we're all emotional when our team loses. So we definitely need that evidence. And let me talk a little bit about the Pacers. You know, I for the hoops heads, and we haven't had a show in a while. We're talking a lot about getting into the sports deep. But I was really impressed with those Indiana Pacers. I really, really was. They were amazing. And it's hard for me to say that because I'm rooting against them. But I mean, if you're like an old school fan of basketball, I don't know how you don't like Tyrese Haliburton. He's like an old school point guard. You know, they used to have orchestrators, whether it's Magic, whether it's Isaiah, whether it was Stockton, whether it was Kidd, whether it was Peyton, whether it was Steve Nash. You had people who were like the floor general ran the offense. And then we're in the era of the combo guard. We don't have that anymore. And I'm just watching Tyrese Haliburton in awe. And how controlled he is and how he sees everything. He might go inside the paint, then pull it back out, hit a crazy three to banks off the end of the rim to have an epic game one loss by the Knicks. But he did so much. He had a 30-point triple-double. But the incredible thing is he had no turnovers. Like, that's unheard of. You know, I don't know if someone ran the stats, if somebody else ever did that, but that's amazing. That's the control that he has. He's a coach on the floor. You got a guy like Pascal Siakam, who could be a complete star on another team and plays within his role. And when he needs to, he could drop 39 points. Miles Turner plays within his role. The subs come in. You saw what Nesmith did first game. They play like a team, like a glove. Rick Carlisle's a great coach. And you can tell great coaching when you look at defense, when you look at the traps. Now, I can sit here and argue that they should have called a lot more fouls on that defense sack in the Knicks. That said, I saw like a team that I rarely see in the era of chucking threes, right? So even though I do not believe they will win the finals, I believe OKC is the best team out. It hurts me to say. Actually, it's like impossible for me to say because of their style of basketball. I'll root for them over OKC because I don't like OKC's style of basketball. I don't like, even though they have great players, they have 40% shooters and hit those threes. And Shea is undoubtedly an incredible player. I don't like the whistles that the refs give him. He's so good, you don't need to give him all these extra whistles. And I say that, and there's a little flopping action there. You know, Doris Burke is under heat because she correctly said the free throw merchant. And a lot of people hated Doris Burke, and now the NBA, there are rumors that Doris Burke, the great TV analyst, may not be around, or what we call being Jeff Van Gundy'd, because Jeff Van Gundy was too critical of the refs, and that's not helping the product. But the truth is, there's some, you know, some terrible reffing. And if I'm going to be 100% honest, my guy, Jalen Brunson, benefited, one of the guys who benefits from some of that, those calls as well. So I got to be honest, trying. But I don't like it. I don't like flopping. And one of the cool things you did not see really that much in the Indiana Knicks series, you didn't see that a lot of that flopping stuff. You didn't see it. So actually, one of the reasons I like the NBA, the WNBA, you don't see a lot of flopping. Because in recent years, they were more physical. Pre-Caitlin Clark, and now everything's like a big deal if she's lightly fouled. But before that, you don't see flopping. And it was one of the ways that I think WNBA is more aesthetically pleasing. Now, next, Mike, we want to go to break?
Load up the Pro Tools and press 3. Studio filled with Jack in the Box and Pepsis. Watching War Star videos, not the SBs. Laughing at B-Pump or stomach turning. I get up and proceeded to write some. Absol in the corner, mumbling raps. Fumbling packs of Blackie Miles. Crumbling Kush till he cracked a smile. His words legendary, wishing I could rhyme like him. Studied the style to define my pen. That was back when the only goal was to get J-Rock through the dough. Warner Brother Records, hope Naeem Ali would let us know. Was excited just to go to them label meetings. Wasn't my record deal, but still, I couldn't believe. Me and Rock inside the booth hibernating. It was simple math. If he made it, then he not made it. Everything I had was for the team. I remained patient, grinding with my brothers. It was us against them, no one above us. Bless our hearts.
Okay, we are back. I'm going to share a couple of afterthoughts on WNBA and Caitlin, which I touched upon. And then we're going to go to the phones. And for those who want to know, it's 202-588-0893. Here's what I want to say a little bit about the WNBA, because we've had a couple of weeks without Caitlin Clark. And yeah, I watched the Fever games. And oh my God, Mystics playing. They have a future, by the way. Mystics. We're going to have to do an episode on the Mystics with the two great rookies. Coming up, just so impressed with the future that they will have. But regarding the WNBA, and we were talking about fouls, is that there's a history to the NBA that it used to be an incredible physical league. It peaked in the 90s with, and I'm a Knicks fan, and we were beating everybody up. You came in the lane, and Charles Oakley and Anthony Mason sent you on your butt. And I could admit that maybe it got too physical, right? And then they sort of changed some rules, and then there was a huge Ron Artest into the stands. And what happened after Ron Artest, and it's documented in a book called After Artest, is David Stern went racist. That's the best way I can explain it. And he started changing all these rules. He was worried about alienating white fans in middle America. This is all well documented. He hired a Republican strategist to appeal to those white fans, those same white fans who love violence and hockey, the same white fans who love brawls and baseball, and said it was all part of the game. But when it happened in a predominantly black sport, that it was a problem. We had people going to stands in hockey. People might know in 1978, Phil Esposito. You might know that. He's been the first, person to go in the stands. But then he loses his mind, and they start changing all the rules. And I'm not going to get into all the details. But essentially, what's that? We had a call? All right, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Am I on?
You're on. What is your question?
Oh, I don't have a question. I wanted to talk about something that was little known, happened a couple of years ago, about the racism in the Baltimore Ravens. And I was kind of upset that it hadn't gotten a lot of attention at the time when I know you probably know about the squeegeer here in Baltimore who killed a white man. And the Ravens, the day before his sentencing, the Ravens put up at the game, the Ravens put his picture up on a jumbotron and basically honored him on the jumbotron, and which I got upset because it was really racist, because I'm wondering how many of us have been killed in gun violence, and none of us have been honored by the Ravens on the jumbotron at the game and honored at the game. And and then I want to connect the dots a little bit as far as the Ivan the Terrible Bates, who wanted to put this child in jail for 60 years. And now he's, standing here in Baltimore with the IDF. And I'm like, why is the IDF here in Baltimore? And why is he taking pictures with the IDF in Baltimore? Is this a genocide coming? It's a connection, because there's a genocide coming here too. And then I would like to also say real quick that the world, it's not just the United States, the world is standing by watching the genocide. Why is it that the world, the UN has to abide by a veto of the United States? The other countries doesn't have to stand by what the UN does. They can take their own actions, which they're not doing. And they're equivocating, saying stuff like, oh, they may be committing genocide. They could be committing genocide. Or if they don't stop this, then they use those types of words. And so they're complicit with the United States for doing this.
Well, first of all, your name again?
Louise.
I'm sorry?
Louise, I didn't know you wanted my name. Louise.
Oh, Louise. No, it's all fine. So, Louise, listen, thank you. You made some very important comments. And the first part, I did not know about. I did not know that they honored the white man. And while you were talking and sharing that, and I never heard about it, I'm not sure what year it was. I'm the first person that came into my head was like Corrin Gaines was gunned down, by police in Baltimore. So many people were gunned down, exactly. And that they would select a white man, because that's important. Because like, if we're going to have an argument or we're going to have a discussion about what is the role of sports, and when people say keep politics out of sports, that's an incredible piece of information that we should talk about. Do you know what year it was?
It was a couple of years. It was a couple of years ago. It was a big thing, it was mob rule and, a high tech lynching of this young child, at the time. And because they had a whole campaign, because they was under, and then Marilyn Mosby, she that's before they went after her. And they were going after her at the time. So she didn't do anything because they were going after her. And so That was the beginning of her, you know, them basically, you know, trying to get her out of office.
I'm gonna look into that. And by the way, you know, I covered the Baltimore uprising in depth and you know, saw how, you know, everybody got off and some of the machinations of how they got off. They're all six people who killed Freddie Gray were all in a van and they couldn't decide which one. They all had bench trials and the judge lets them all off. Whereas if like if I'm in a getaway car and somebody else robs a store, I'm liable as a citizen, even if I don't even know that they robbed the store, and they jump in the getaway car, and if they killed someone, everyone in that car is getting the sentence. But when it happens to police all in the same car, they do not. You have to find out more information. Go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
I was going to say that's the same thing I was thinking about with the people who supposedly stormed the Capitol or whatever, and they police officers got killed, and they got an array of charges, but none of it was murder or attempted murder or anything like that. And I was thinking to myself, I said, why not? I said, just like you said, if I was in a car and somebody robbed a store and they came out and I had nothing to do with it, but I'm in that car, I'm getting charged too. And if he murders somebody in the process, I'm getting charged too. So, exactly. You know, it's a double standard, you know, all the way around.
It's a double standard. It's a triple standard, quadruple standard. I want to hit your second point because I think it's important. I may be a little bit more charitable than you, but, you know, I could be wrong. It was, okay, how come first of all, why does the United States have veto power? And the United States has veto power after, you know, World War II, five countries were given this ridiculous veto power, and it's horrible. So even like a vote on Cuba, to we remove sanctions on Cuba, there are only two countries that vote. It's like 189-2, and it's Israel and the United States. That's the only reason that sanctions haven't been lifted on Cuba. And it's like that vote every single year. So it's actually, if you really think about it, the way the UN has the veto power and then the allegiance of the United States to everything, Israel, they're a world dictator. The United States is a world dictator because anytime people try to get justice through the UN, they can block it. They're literally a world dictator. The reason I'm a little more charitable is because there is a country that's gone out of their way to help Palestinians, and that country is Yemen. And the thanks that Yemen gets for trying to do, according to national law, international law, and intervene and stop the passageways in the Red Sea and block the weapons from coming, what they get is bombs. What they get is obliterated by the United States of America.
I am saying
when a country has to move forward and make the decision to intervene, they also know that America is going to bomb them. I'm just saying that's the whole equation.
But is America going to bomb England? Is America going to bomb? Is America going to bomb Germany? No, I'm talking about the colonial powers. I'm talking about the colonial powers. So you know, so
you came back good.
Yeah. I'm not talking about people like the stand-up countries like Yemen.
You're right. No, I picked the one that is intervening. But you're right. And I thank you for that. You're right. No, they're not going to. The United States is not going to bomb England, and they're not going to bomb Germany. And when you talk about the European countries, I mean, there are about 10 of the European countries who do have supported a ceasefire. But I think one of the more vocal ones, like I would say Ireland. If you look at Ireland. The people, if you look at the people, they're very much because, you know, Ireland, it's not exactly the same, but Ireland has a history of being colonized. And itself, so they have an understanding of what that is, but the leadership in Ireland does not represent the people in Ireland, and that is clear.
No, the leadership has come. The leadership has supported the Palestinians in Ireland, and South Africa has stood up. And you know, and as you know, as you've already said, you know, gone to the court, the ICC. You know, to take Israel to task for this. So there are countries, but I'm talking about the colonial powers who are sitting up there hem-hawing around, you know, basically hiding behind, you know, the veto. They can say, oh, the UN Council can vote. The rest of the UN Council can vote for a ceasefire as long as they know that the United States is going to veto it. They can hide behind that. And I just don't think that they should
right, and that's what they're doing. But I think you said the answer in your comments. You said colonial powers. By the way, we're going to go have shorter calls, but you're just dropping so many gems here. So
sorry.
We're running with it. I love it.
Okay,
I love it. Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate the counterpoints. But you're right. But you said the colonial powers, and when you say the colonial powers, that's the reason. You know, colonizers going to colonize. Colonizers going to support other colonizers. And you know, the United States does that. So I think that's what you're seeing. I think you're seeing people on the same team.
Just real quick, I just wanted to tell you that I wanted to bring that up with the Ravens at the time, but I'm not on social media. So the only time I can, you know, say anything is the, you know, call. That's all. So I can't get in contact with y'all
research.
Otherwise.
Louise, you're going to make me do some research. I'm going to do research on this one. So I thank you. You know, if nothing, you like, I did not know that. And that's something that should be amplified, particularly in this time. So thank you. And then also thank you for that point about, you know, you're talking about police here. It's going to happen here. And I would say it's going to happen in the form of cop cities that are being proliferated all over the country. And that was not just happening with Trump. That was happening with Biden. And those are the blueprints where many Gazas will show itself. So I think we have to fight these things no matter what the administration is. I don't like Trump as president at all, but I always have to question, why do some people only fight back under Trump and they don't fight back under the same oppression when there's a different president? That I've always struggled with that. Like, why does that have to be that case? But I thank you so much. I thank you so much. And Mike, are there any other callers? Okay. So listen, that was a great discussion. We could have gone a whole second half hour on that discussion. The number is 202-588-0893. And the bar has been set very, very high as far as knowledge dropping, 202-588-0893. Back to the WNBA for a moment. And we were talking about Caitlin Clark. We were talking about, I want to talk about Angel Reese, and I want to talk about sort of the foul situation. And the way the foul situation is such is that the WNBA is going to start moving towards flopping because there are these calls and these outcries every time Caitlin is fouled hard. And then what happens is it starts to change the whole sport itself. And it's interesting. I have been watching the Fever games about Caitlin. The problem, they haven't had a point guard. They're 1-2. They haven't had a point guard. But now they think they just signed a new point guard who is the backup. And they have some good players there. But I think the Fever will be better off for it because they're seeing adjustments. But they have an odd thing where their best point guards and ball handlers in some ways are Aaliyah Boston and DeWanna Bonner. And they're tall, you know, they're front court people, but they're far more comfortable handling the ball. No disrespect to Sydney Colson at all, but she's a 35-year-old vet who hasn't played more than 8 minutes a game since 2019, never scored really more than 3 points a game. So, you know, her role is supposed to be about, you know, 5 minutes, 8 minutes, not more than that. You can't ask her to play 20 minutes. You're at a deficit. So sometimes you need a backup to come in. But I think they look very good in that last game. And, you know, with that, I have spent over a year in discussions and interactions with this Caitlin fan base. And if you've listened, you know I've been very critical of that fan base. Very, very critical of that fan base. Not the whole fan base. I don't want to say the whole fan base, but I've often said, if you came to the WNBA for Caitlin's greatness, great. You could stay. If you came to the WNBA for Caitlin's whiteness, you need to go, because there's this toxic group of people. Many came from Outkick. Many came from Barstool Sports. It's really led by white men. That would be actually a surprise to a lot of people. is led by white men who are watching the WNBA for the first time and said, we've blessed you with our presence. Be thankful for the ratings that we give you. And you should take any abuse, and any black WNBA player should take any abuse that we give, because that's part of the deal. And I'd be more than happy to see half of them go away and have a more incremental rise. I'll also say that the WNBA had, in 2023, with the Aces back-to-back championships, led by Aja Wilson, the best player in the WNBA, they had their best viewership in 21 years. Not the Caitlin effect, but they already had their best viewership in 21 years. And that Aces attendance went up 66%. This is 2023. So it was a little bit on the rise, and it was growing. And then they made this huge jump. But if you're saying is a more moderate rise better and losing some of the toxicity of the fans, yeah. And what I mean by that is that it's almost impossible to have even a basketball discussion with a lot of these people, because I've tried like hundreds of times. You can't even critique basketball. Talk about it, strengths and weaknesses. That means you hate Caitlin Clark. And if you're black, it's you hate white people. You know, like that's where it ends up. Any normal basketball discussion. And so that's it's very interesting. And then the part that I really don't like about the other part of it is that, you know, Angel Reese, you have a discussion about Angel Reese and this group will just say Angel Reese sucks. That's like the standard answer. And how can that be true, Baltimore's own? How can that be true if you set the WNBA record as a rookie of rebounding? Like, how can that be true? But the people who hate her judge her by her scoring, but she's not a scorer. I never remember people saying Dennis Rodman, you know what, you stink because you can't score. Because she reminds me of Dennis Rodman. I'm going to be honest, if you actually look at how she plays and her motor and how she goes after rebounds, is Dennis Rodman, who had a career average. Okay, who had a career average of 7.4 points a game, and no one said he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame because he only scored 7.4. She does rebounding and defense best. So we have a new caller. Do you have a question?
Yeah, yes, it is Marvin from Fort Washington. How you doing, man?
Hey, how are you, Marvin?
Hey, Coach, fine. Yeah, I work in public safety. In D.C. and you know, we have had a protest on our campus. I'm not going to say where I work at, but. I just want to commend you and your work as far as covering these encampments, like what happened in GW, and the uprisings of students all over this country, man. And you know, a lot of these students are paying the price, man. A lot. I heard down in GW they had stripped some of these students, diplomas, man, because they spoke out. Yeah,
yes.
And you know, it's crazy what they're doing, man. And you know, the campus police down there, man, I was going to work for GW, but I refused to work. I mean, I see the level of abuse and abuse of their powers as campus police and DC police to try to silence these students, man, and the universities, man. You know,
yeah,
so
right.
I appreciate your work, man, as far as covering these in campus, man.
Hey, Marvin, I appreciate your comments. Thank you. And, you know, everything you're saying is right. During the university and the police and MPD were working together. They were working together. Actually, the university wanted MPD to move in even quicker on those raids, on those encampments, on those students. And I know we're coming close to the end, so I want to leave on so much of a positive note. So I interview a lot of protests all the time. I've been doing it for years. And there was something different about the resistance when the encampment and how not just how knowledgeable all the young people were. And they could break down all the investments and weapons manufacturers that their university had. So their knowledge is off the charts. But also, I was speaking to a couple of young people, and this was off the record because they did not want to be videoed, who were being expelled. And normally it's, oh my God, woe is me. And the mood of about three or four people who were being expelled was, if my university is in bed with weapons manufacturers and helping to commit a genocide, then I don't want a diploma from my university. Forget them. Stronger language than that. And I was like, whoa, this is like a little new day, you know? And now their parents, who might have been paying that tuition bill may have a different opinion on the matter. But what I am saying is there are people out there who know a genocide is happening. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard is, what can they do to me that's worse than a genocide? Like, that's the answer. And the answer is no. And I don't think the powers that be understand that level of commitment.
Thanks for having the time. Appreciate it, man.
Appreciate you. So I know we're coming around that time, Magic Mike, right? Yeah, we're coming around that time. So listen, it was great to have some callers. One, we ran for 15 minutes because all the gems that were being dropped in that conversation, and really appreciate you. And really appreciate what you bring in, and really appreciate all the WPFW listeners. DZ and Atan will be back next week, and we're gonna talk a little bit Knicks. And soon enough, we're also gonna have some guests. Maybe look out for Monica McNutt, so you don't want to miss that as well. So listen, I'm not gonna do what my man DZ says. That's his signature, but I'm just gonna say it's great to be out there, and let's just keep fighting, and let's keep fighting back. And we'll see you next week.
Robin Holden.
Hi, I'm Miyuki Williams.
WPFW and Parks and People invite you to the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, from 12 noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park.
It's a family-friendly celebration of culture, community, and resistance during the week of Juneteenth and the summer solstice.
Experience the power of WPFW's on-air voices brought to life with featured speakers Anthony Browder and Reverend Lennox Yearwood.
Live performances by Saiz Kamaldeen, Kabah, and Proverbs, plus DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog, keeping the vibe alive.
Connect in the community, led by Milani Douglas. Explore art curated by Adrian Ferguson and enjoy intergenerational fun with activities for elders and children alike.
That's Sunday, June 22nd at Malcolm X Meridian Hill Park from noon.